Welcome to the deep dive. Today we're trying to do something maybe a little impossible. We're trying to bring objective structure to the absolute chaos of radical reality TV.
Yeah, we're diving into this thing called the Fish Tank Treatise. It's this, massive framework for trying to calculate the value of every single second on screen.
And the central problem here feels huge. How do you objectively define content when my idea of entertainment is totally different from yours?
That's the philosophical challenge. Because if we, the viewers, just say content is what I enjoyed watching, then, well, there's no stable ground for analysis at all.
Exactly. I mean, viewers see it subjectively. If they fast forward, it's non-tent. If they clip it and post it, it's content. The treatise basically says that approach is useless for any real analysis.
The whole mission is to just throw personal enjoyment out the window. It tries to set up a fixed analytical definition for content. You know, something grounded in concepts everyone can recognize.
So it doesn't matter if I personally liked it.
It doesn't. It only matters if it's possible for someone to be entertained by it. That's the reference point.
Okay, so for this deep dive, we're going to cover that foundational concept, then the three filters an action has to pass, and then get into the really complex stuff, the three classification criteria, C1, C2, and C3.
So let's get into the fundamentals. It all starts with recognizing value, not actually feeling pleasure from it.
Which brings us to this core idea, universally recognizable entertainment value, or UREV. But if it's not about my enjoyment, doesn't that make the whole system kind of cynical? Like it just values conflict for the sake of it?
It is cynical, but that's the point. I mean, to be objective, it has to admit that this genre, especially radical reality TV, is built on dramatic conflict.
Right.
So URE just means you can see why other people might be entertained by something, even if you personally are not.
So, okay, if a fish gets into a huge, messy fight, I might be cringing, right?
Yeah.
I might want to look away.
Yeah.
But I still have to admit that, yeah, for this genre, that's entertainment. It has UREV.
Precisely. UREV loves drama, conflict, tension, spectacle, and it just completely rejects what it calls passive observation.
Like a fish just sleeping all day.
Or staring at a wall. That's just background noise.
Okay, which brings us to the filtering mechanism. UREV is step one, but it's not enough. We have the effort-filled content test, the EFC test. Let's break down these three filters.
The first one's pretty simple. Non-basic action. The action can't be part of the basic human condition. So, you know, breathing, sleeping, just walking around, that's out.
But there's a loophole, right? A unique addition can make a basic action count.
Exactly. Standing on your feet for an hour is nothing. But standing on your head for an hour, that's content. Eating a normal meal is basic, but eating like 6 raw onions on a dare, that's non-basic.
Okay, makes sense. What's filter 2?
Second is our cornerstone, UREV present. The action has to have that universally recognizable value we just talked about.
And the third one deals with repetition. It's called uncommon occurrence. So an action has to avoid becoming, what's the term, functionally basic.
Yeah, functionally basic. This is governed by the law of diminishing content returns.
The audience just gets used to it.
They get used to it so fast. Think of it like living next to a train track. After a while, you just stop hearing the trains go by. That really unique catchphrase that was funny the first 10 times.
It becomes background noise.
It becomes functionally basic. The UREV completely erodes. To counteract that, the treatise says it needs a unique flair or a new context to sort of reset the clock.
Got it. Okay, before we get into classifying this stuff, we have to mention the one big exception, the first day rule.
Yes. For simplicity, day one produces zero content, period.
Why is that?
Well, you have all the technical issues, the cast is just meeting, it's awkward, but more importantly, the audience has this content withdrawal bias. Everyone is so desperate for drama after a break that their judgment is skewed.
So you just have to wait for things to settle down.
You wait until day two for any real clean analysis to start.
So once an action passes the EFC test, and it's not day one, we can finally classify it. It gets sorted into one or more of three criteria. Let's start with the easy one, criterion one.
C1 is content where the UREV is intrinsic. It's inherent to the action itself. You could take away all the context and it would still be a spectacle.
This is the stuff that gets clipped and goes viral.
Oh, absolutely. C1 is highly clippable. We're talking about, you know, huge mental breakdowns, projectile vomiting, screaming matches, saying slurs.
And the treatise is really clear here. You have to separate morality from entertainment.
Yeah.
Controversy is spectacle.
And spectacle is C1. A true C1 action is just so shocking or dramatic that it doesn't need a story. It just is.
Okay, now it's, I think, really interesting. Criterion 2, C2. This is all about the relational variable. The value isn't in the action itself.
No, it's derived entirely from the expectation of a response.
So you're setting someone else up.
You're creating a catalyst, an effort-filled catalyst. You're giving another person another fish, production, a freeloader, a valid opportunity to respond. The UREV comes from us, the audience, waiting for that response.
Which means we have to immediately start talking about different kinds of catalysts.
Yeah.
Because that opportunity can be really fragile.
It's extremely fragile. You have ephemeral catalysts first. These are verbal or immediate physical things, like screaming in someone's face.
Or shove.
Or shove. Think of it like a whisper. Uh-huh. If no one's there to hear it, it's gone. It dies instantly. No opportunity to respond means it fails C2.
And the opposite of that is a persistent catalyst.
Right. Persistent catalysts are physical. They leave a footprint.
Like kicking a hole in the wall.
Kicking a hole in the wall, destroying someone's clothes, leaving a huge mess. That physical footprint extends the valid opportunity to respond into the future. It lies dormant, waiting to be discovered.
Okay, but this all seems to rely on this concept of natural means. The valid way someone can respond based on what they actually know. And this is where production just messes everything up, right?
It complicates things immensely, especially with ephemeral, with the verbal stuff. Say a fish is in a room alone, just ranting. For that to be a C2 catalyst, the treatise says production must be invoked by the fish.
So the fish has to say, like, production, are you hearing this?
Something like that. And production has to acknowledge it later. If that doesn't happen, the rant just dies in the room. No C2.
Which leads to this huge C2 failure point. The natural means violation.
Yeah.
Let's use the example. Fish one rants privately about fish two. Later, production shows that clip to fish two to start drama. Fish one gets zero C2 credit. Why?
Because the original catalyst, the rant, was ephemeral and it died. It had no natural means for fish two to respond. When production shows the clip, that's a brand new catalyst.
So production becomes the actor.
Production becomes the actor. It's what the treatise calls a role shift. Fish 2 is responding to production's action, not Fish 1's original rant. So production gets the C2 credit, Fish 1 gets nothing.
That feels so unfair to the person who put in the effort.
It's strict, but it has to be, analytically. The system wants to reward catalysts that actually generate organic dynamics, not just raw material. Production can use later.
But what about the persistence exception? If Fish 1 destroys Fish 2's clothes, a persistent catalyst, and then production tells Fish 2 about it. Does Fish 1 still get the C2 credit?
Yes. That's the key difference. Because the destroyed clothes are a physical footprint, they maintain natural means. The evidence is still discoverable.
So production's meddling doesn't matter as much.
It doesn't violate the natural means because Fish 2 could have found the clothes anyway. The opportunity was kept alive by the physical evidence. Fish 1 gets their C2 credit.
Okay, so C2 is all about direct response. What if an action is really important, but no one sees it and it doesn't leave a footprint?
And that is the perfect transition. We're moving from the micro-relational to the macro. We're moving to the final category, criterion 3 content.
C3.
This is content that gets its UREV purely from narrative significance. The action has to contribute to what the treatise calls a major plot line.
So this is about how the small moments feed into the big season-long story. But I'm guessing not just any story counts.
No, it filters out the boring stuff. For a plotline to be major, it needs to meet two requirements. First, it has to be universally recognizable.
Meaning the whole audience knows this is a defining story of the season.
Yes, it can't be some niche thing only a few people care about. Second, the underlying conflict itself has to pass the EFC test. The tension has to be non-basic. It can't just be, I want to win the show, or I'm hungry. It has to be, you know, raw hatred, complex manipulation, a deep personal struggle.
Okay, so let's use an example. We have a major plot line. Fish A has this deep, unrequited crush on Fish B. Fish A then secretly leaves a piece of chocolate on Fish B's pillow. It's a small, effort-filled action.
If that plot line is major, that tiny action becomes massive C3 content.
Even if Fish B never sees it.
Even if Fish B never sees it, it's not a persistent catalyst. The URV is now totally narrative-based. We, the viewers, are invested in the story. We see the dramatic irony. The action pushes the narrative forward in our minds. If that plot line was minor, though, leaving the chocolate would be nothing. It would fail C3.
Wow, so the narrative structure is a huge content multiplier.
It absolutely is. And that's where production's influence gets really, really tempting.
Because major plot lines are these self-sustaining content engines fueled by real emotion, and production wants to rush that.
They can try to force a minor plotline to become universally recognizable, you know, with specific challenges or leading questions in confessionals.
So that creates an artificial plotline.
And that's the risk. If the fish don't have that genuine emotional investment, if they're just kind of following production's hints, the whole thing is fragile. It needs constant intervention or it just collapses. The content feels forced.
Whereas a natural plotline is robust because it was forged over time with real emotion.
Time acted as a filter.
Okay, so wrapping this all up, what does it all mean? We've gone from the tiniest unit, UREV, filtered with the EFC test, and then classified it by spectacle with C1, relationships with C2, or story with C3.
Yeah, the framework basically turns this volatile, chaotic show into something almost like calculable theory. And what's really important is that one action can score in all three categories.
Right.
A fish publicly destroying another's belongings. That's C1 for the spectacle. It's C2 as a persistent catalyst. And it's C3 if it moves a major conflict forward. The best content, the most valuable content, scores across the board.
So this whole deep dive, this part one, has really just set the stage for understanding why the show's quality can swing so wildly.
Exactly. And future analysis using this treatise shifts the focus from just the actions to the fish themselves. You start aggregating the data to see who is mathematically the biggest content creator and why they're so crucial to a season's success or failure.
That leaves a pretty big question for you, the listener, to think about.
Mm-hmm. If the quality of the content really depends so much on these objective rules, on maintaining complex systems like natural means, what responsibility do the showrunners have to not break their own content machine? I mean, they can manipulate and rush all of this, but does that ultimately cause the whole thing to just collapse under its own weight? They're the ones managing the chaos they're trying to analyze.